We're gonna be in the mountains, sorry.
You're starting soon.
Smoking?
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah, down there, like outside Asheville.
Nice.
So there's a, we got a family wedding we're gonna go to, so.
Great.
It'll be down there.
Great.
I'm sure we'll have a cell signal.
Now, are you stressing that?
Well, guess if you turn it off, then you won't get a signal, right?
They'll never know, right?
You just turn it off and say, no signal.
Yeah.
Didn't get it.
Okay, we'll be here when you get back.
I know, everything will be.
We'll get started. Just a couple of things on the agenda today. Linda Messick could not make it, and Karen Brewington could not make it, so they won't be here. First up, State of Delaware State Pool Presentation. Mr. David Craik is here to speak to us about the State of Delaware State Pool, and welcome, David. This is our pension committee.
Okay. I'm Dave Craik. I'm the pension administrator for the state, and I've been here before, but it's probably been a long time. Probably when Dave was in Susie's position back then. It's probably the last time I've been here. I gave you two pieces of paper, basically, and unfortunately, they're from our, well, the first page with investment returns are as of June 30th of 11. Currently, we're processing and putting together our annual report for June 30th of 12, and that'll be available in the fall. Basically, here's our returns for the last 15 years. The last 10 years are broken out. I can tell you as of June 30th of 12, we're at 2% for the year ending June 30th of 12. So that, since we're at 2%, our, both our 5-year, 10-year, and 15-year numbers dropped down a little bit. I know our 15-year number is down to 7.6% for the last 15 years. The second piece of paper I gave you is really our asset allocation, and on the left of that is as of March 31st. So it's pretty current there. So you can see all the different asset class that we have. What's happened since March 31st, if we've actually done some conservative moves. We moved $250 million out of some international equity into some domestic equity and fixed income. So we're kind of conservative. The outlook, probably the same thing you're hearing, is flat in the U.S. Just not sure what's going on in Europe and China are some concerns. So we took some conservative moves here the last couple months. Probably what's different about us is our private program, kind of the left-hand top corner there. So we're up to about 22% in non-traditional assets. Give you an example of that. You might have heard about Facebook went public in May. We were a big investor in Facebook when it first started up, and we got in at 6 cents a share is when we got in. So when they went public, we sold 30% of our holdings and made $50 million the day they went public. Of course, they've dropped down quite a bit, but still getting in at 6 cents a share, we still have a pretty large position in Facebook. So that doesn't show up into our performance until September 30th quarter, because we lag these alternative investments a quarter for reporting. So that's just an example. That's going to be one of our home runs we hit. Hopefully we hit hits and not outs, but definitely that's we're going to be one of our home runs that we have. So at this point, I'll just open up for any questions that you might have.
Is that successful sale reflected in the 2%?
No.
Okay.
No. That'll show up in our September 30th performance.
Okay.
Now will all that show up, or have you had to increase the
The value has been increasing. I'm not sure what they were valued as of March 31st. I'm not sure what that value was.
Can you talk a little bit about your board and who sits on it and how often they meet and what kind of schedule they have and what they do?
Okay. Probably the big thing is our investment committee, which is a subcommittee of our pension board. They actually meet 17 to 18 times a year, usually twice a month and once for some months. They're made up of investment professionals. Our investment committee, they're appointed by the board. The chair right now is Dale Stratton, who I think some of you might have met years ago. She used to be chair of the pension board, but now she's chairing our investment committee, retired from DuPont. We've got a retired treasurer from Hercules, some other retired DuPont people, so we draw on the local community for that. As far as their pension board, it's a seven-member board appointed by the governor. Ann Vasalli, the OMB director, and Tom Cook, the secretary of finance, serve by nature of their position. And then we have five appointments. Right now, the chair is Suzanne Grant, who was appointed in January as chair. She's retired, but exposed to the investment community and so forth.
So you have a board and then under that an investment committee?
Yes.
And how does the relationship work between the investment committee and the board and then an actual transaction?
Yeah, the investment committee makes recommendations to the board, and then the board would approve those recommendations. The board meets 11 times a year, once a month, every month except August. If there has to be some investment action, we'll do it through a poll vote and then ratify that at the next board meeting. So a lot of communication up from the investment committee to our board members.
Those are meetings, or the board meetings, I guess, are open to. I think you invited us in the past if you wanted to.
Yeah, the board meetings, the investment committee are open, but they do go in executive session for most of that meeting, the investment committees. But you still have managers down talking to them and so forth.
And you hire you have a main investment manager, correct?
We have an investment advisor.
Investment advisor.
Yeah, Ashford Capital Management out of Wilmington. They've been our advisor for quite a long time. We're up to about $7.5 billion in assets, total assets that we have right now. Now, you guys...
And they advise the board.
Pardon me?
They advise the board.
Yeah,
or
the committee. They advise the committee.
I mean the committee, and they make recommendations to the board.
That's right. That's right.
Your OPEB fund, does that, for benefits, does that, have you made any, it seemed like that was fairly... index oriented, at least as of a year or so ago.
Yeah, when we first set that up based on the feds, we had to keep it separate from the pension assets. So we set up a trust. We have four accounts in Vanguard, all index related. Now the feds have allowed us to commingle the OPEB and pension assets. We have not done that yet. That's our plan, though, to do that at some point. The state, we have about $150 million in our OPEB trust right now. For us, but currently it's still separate like it was when you were in it.
So your plan is to basically invest those funds, the OPEB funds, in the same manner you invest the pension
into fund. The pension trust, yes.
Just segregate the amounts or somehow.
Yeah.
If the county was ever interested in doing that, and I don't know if they are or not, but would that be an option for the county?
Yeah, you guys can get back in. Kent County, they've given us all their OPEB funds, so they're in the OPEB trust now, but it would be commingled with pension trusts once we did that.
When do you expect to do that?
It's on our calendar to discuss this next quarter, so I'm thinking sometime in the next 12 months.
So then it would have the advantage of being managed with your investment committee and just like all your other regular pension assets?
Yes.
And the leverage.
There appears to be a slight lessening in debt from 2011 to 2012. Of course, I know as a pension, you have to be conservative. Is part of the reason for this because there is most likely going to be an increase within maybe a year or two of somewhat of interest rates, so that would have an effect on the bond value. Is that part of the reason that this is very slight, it's only a couple percent.
Yeah, no.
They
haven't made any moves based on interest rate projections at all.
It's down the road, I guess, but it's not not here yet.
Yeah, we have a pretty large cash balance. Our pension plans are in a negative cash flow situation, so we need cash to pay benefits each month. So that's why we probably have normal or higher than normal cash than some plans might have.
That's what you mean.
What's your, on your pension fund, your actuary, have they adjusted the 8% assumed return yet? Or have you, done anything there?
Yeah, last June we dropped it to 7.5%.
And that would be June of 11?
Yep.
Is that when your report is out?
Yeah.
Is that when you, okay.
The private program investments, I know you mentioned Facebook. What other type of investments do you have there?
A lot of IT related, similar to Facebook. We have, last couple of years, put some funds into some China funds. There's an India fund. There's some biotech type things that are kind of located up in the northeast of the U.S.
Is it all private equity or the hedge funds or what else might be in there?
There's a couple hedge funds. We actually created our own hedge funds with long short managers in 2008. And we put about $200 million into that hedge fund. We are terminating that. We're unwinding that. It didn't work out as well as we thought. The timing was bad with 2008. But most of them are going to be private partnerships.
Do you ever get in a situation where, say, a legislator or a governor or somebody says, you know, well, we'd like to see an investment in a business in Kent County? A new business in King County, we'd like to invest in that through the pension fund?
Yeah, to answer your question, yes, all the time. The governor, I mean, he understands what we do. Usually when we're getting into these partnerships, the minimum investment we're putting in is $100 million. I mean, we could not do any of those deals in Delaware. They're all much smaller than that. So that's kind of how we avoid those discussions with the governor, especially the governor. He knows that we're looking things 100 million or higher to do the deals we're doing.
So that doesn't really happen?
No.
What's the strategies category?
That's a couple of companies we have, and they'll do anything to try to make a profit.
That's like your Wildcatters or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, Angelo Gordon is one of them. I don't know if Michael knows about them, but he described it one time when he came to talk to us. If he found a old shoe in the curb and could make some money on it, he would try to do it. But they're into a little bit of everything. They're doing some debt, distressed debt. They have some hedge funds within those strategies, real estate, trying to buy something cheap and sell it for a profit.
Just out of curiosity, how did you obtain Facebook at 6 cents per share? I mean, I know it had to be some time ago, but.
Oh, yeah. But years ago, through one of the private equity managers, as they were trying to raise funds, one of the relationships we had bought into it. It worked out pretty well.
But you didn't invest $100 million 6 cents a share?
No.
Did you say you made $50 million on selling it
we,
back
we
when they
30,
made the offering?
We sold 30% of our holdings and got $50 million.
Could you talk a little bit more on the fixed income? And the reason why I bring this up is that, as I've always said, we wrote a conservative investment policy statement, and Sussex County wanted to be even more conservative. So I think maybe give them some flavor of the types of fixed income that they invest through yours, which would not be the same as, you know, your guidelines that you have with it.
Yeah. One of the moves we just did, we took some money out of the high yield category, and can't remember where we ended up putting that in, but still kept it in the bond area. So we're always looking at the different categories of the fixed income. It just felt high yield was getting a little risky at this point. The bank debt, that's something we got into in 08 and 09 as we tried to recover from our losses. It's okay, what fixed income vehicles can we get into that are going to be protected also? So that was some of the decision behind the bank debt. I think we just moved our high yield into some long bond funds that we have.
What is the state's goal per year in appreciation? Ours is 8%.
7.5.
Return, 7.5.
Yep, 7.5.
So did I understand you correctly that our investment in the state pool
is not in exactly this asset allocation that you're showing us. We have a customized allocation.
No, you're in this allocation right here. When you were in the OPEB fund, that was different. That was with the OPEB funds was different. But your funds are divided exactly like this.
Thank you.
Me?
We invested years ago.
Can I grab that from Dr. Hawk? I've got somebody that needs it right now.
Sure.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Years ago, we started a pension fund with investing through the state. The county started out on its own investing, and we were using fine bonds through Wilmington Trust and then some various mutual funds through Wilmington Trust. And then we got into investing our funds through the state pool, probably 15 years ago, I guess, and started putting a lot of money into the state pool, and that's built up over the years. So now we sort of have a combination, as you know. And then on the OPEB fund, we started 5 years ago, I guess, with the state OPEB fund. But we got out of that mainly because it was index. It was just basically invested in index funds, and we felt like we could do a better job.
Also heard that long-term now, it's been stated that they think maybe just for the next decade that a lot of these pension plans that are maybe going for 7.5% return, 8%, that's not the real world anymore, that you know might want to plan more on 5, which, of course, that has an impact on your contribution that you put into the plan. But what do you think about just maybe going out a few years? Do you think that the 8% and 7.5%, is that going to be realistic?
Our long-term projected return right now is about 7.6, which happens to be what our 15-year past performance is.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a lot of questions, especially on the reporting for accounting of the GASB and other things. They're very conservative. They're looking at rates much lower than what we're assuming.
Yeah.
But I think from a plan administrator, $1 that I'm going to pay out in the future is still $1 no matter what our rate is going to be. So we have to have that dollar available.
Yes.
That's oversimplifying things, but I know Moody's has come out with some projections that they want to do to disclosure when there's bond offerings and so forth. So it looks like we're going to have our pension disclosures and pension funding method that we use. GASB has a new disclosure, and now Moody's has something, and I'm sure the other bond authorities are going to have their own disclosures. So there's multiple disclosures using different interest rates for all those.
Oh, I see. Thank you.
Once again, there's a lot of changes coming to pension from a financial statement perspective. Who's your actuary?
We use a firm called Chiron. They're out of D.C. It's a pretty small firm. They're a spinoff from Milliman. A couple of years ago, they spun off from Milliman.
Are you pleased with them?
Oh, yeah.
I'll add in two of my clients use Chiron. Allentown and Wilmington just hired them also. We've seen them at Allentown for several years.
Is that K-Y-R-O-N?
C-H-E-R-I-O-N.
C-H-E-R-I-O-N. Oh.
It's some Greek god of something.
It looks like Sharyon.
I'll hand this out since they're asking that question.
All right.
This was my hand this out. Anyway, the article that just came out last week in P&I, but it's not. More state plans are cutting their assumed rate of returns. So that was a very timely question.
Yeah, well, I think this year, our actuary's done it at calendar year. We didn't change it in December for that year, but of course,
Have we done a kind of sensitivity analysis that to say what contribution rates would be required for different assumed rates of return?
No.
Just curious, does the state, I know we've been through difficult times, do they provide the appropriate a recommended amount each year by the actuaries for the contribution? Have they been able to do that?
Yeah, we administer 9 different pension plans in our office. The ones that are funded by the state, all but one of them, the state has always made 100% of their annual required contribution. We have a closed state police plan that was for the officers hired before 1980. It's a pay-as-you-go type of plan. But all the others are very well funded. There was a study done, I think, by University of Arizona after the last recession had 6 pension plans that made it through, survived, in good financial shape after the 2008-2009, and we were one of those 6 that they studied. And that was one of the reasons. If you're making 100% of your required contribution, you're going to be in good shape. Yes. If you're Illinois and you consistently put it at 50% or lower, you're going to run into problems at some point.
Right.
Yes.
And then with 2008 and 2009 returns, it just compounded their problems.
Thank you. That's what you mean.
Who else is in the pool besides us and the state in your pool?
Kent County has given us their OPEB money.
Uh-huh.
I believe Ellesmere has given us some pension and maybe Newport. The other big ones have not. We don't have anything from Newcastle County or Dover. Now, they participate for their police officers in our county municipal police pension plan, so we do have those assets from the plan in our plans.
And how much do the state employees, they contribute to their pension?
Yes.
On that end of things, because we're in the midst of a study, you know, to look at that. What do they contribute?
Well, we had pension reform last year, came through the state. If you were hired before January of 12, you pay 3% of your salary above $6,000. New hires after January 1st of 12 now pay 5% of their salary above $6,000. What's interesting is back in 76, the 5% is what was paid at the point. So we kind of went down. Now it's going back up to what it was prior to 76.
Okay. So since 76, the state employees always have had to contribute something to their pension?
Oh, prior to 76, but that's when the plans became actuarial funded at that point and so forth.
Right.
There was a major changes in 76.
And what percentage of payroll the state is contributing to pension and OPEB?
To OPEB? They're not contributing a percentage of payroll. They're just giving us lump sum dollar amounts. For FY13, we've got a $15 million allocation. That's a percentage of payroll, so a very small percentage. And then they've just transferred $11 million from the health fund, some reserves they had. So we're going to get about $26 million coming in for OPEB. I think that was it's about 0.9% of payroll is what it comes out to be, the $15 million.
How about for the regular pension?
For the regular pension, the rate for 13 is 8.9%. Yeah. We lump a lot of different things into the pension rate that they apply in payroll. The biggest thing now is becoming our pay-as-you-go health care. That's about 8.9% also, just to pay the premiums for the next year for retirees.
That's roughly 8.9%
yeah.
also.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in the general fund, I guess, right?
It's in the budget, yeah, so it's coming from general fund as well as special fund money too.
Okay.
It's applied as a percentage of payroll.
There's some comparisons to how the state of Delaware fund does with other funds, other state funds. How does that rack up now? How do you rack up now?
I know the numbers, and these were not reported, but the calendar year end
of 11, I think we are the number one fund for a seven-year return. I mean, so we just picked that since we were number one. I'm going to say the June 30th 11 numbers, we're probably top quartile. And as you get to the longer periods, 10 and 15, we probably are a little bit higher up in the quartile.
What percentage of equities would be your max normally?
Our ranges are very broad. We kind of have a risk control we try to stay under, and the top band on that risk is that the total fund will be 65% of the risk of the S&P 500. But as far as our allocation to equities, we can have, I think it's between 20 and 80% of the fund can be in equities. So we're probably in the middle of that now, but our ranges are very broad.
As on conditions and...
Yeah.
You know, yeah. But it's, yes, thanks.
On this page, under policy ranges, give you the range for each of those asset classes.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So as you can see, domestic 20 to 80, bonds 20 to 80. We do have a minimum on fixed income of 20, not to go below 20.
Any other questions for David? Thank you very much.
Sure,
it was very informative, and you've made it very easy to understand and explained it very well.
Sure. We'll be glad to come down more frequently if you want, instead of every decade.
Annually, I think it's once a year would be a very good idea.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I would say we would have our annual report probably the end of October, so probably right after that might be a good time.
You're welcome to stay and listen to our performance review for the last quarter.
I think I will, because for Kent County, I'm on your side of the table. I sit on the Kent County committee, so I'd like to hear
you. Do ya?
Yeah.
Okay. And next, our performance report for Pierce Park Group.
Okay. First, I'll just add, although it wasn't specifically on the agenda, that you saw the article I handed out, but that was an issue we spoke at it. I spoke about the last meeting that, longer term, you need to be looking at longer term rates of return assumptions. That over the 1990s, return assumptions sort of crept up as returns crept up. But you really need to have a what's a realistic long-term rate of return that you have? The trade-off is when you lower your return assumptions, it does increase your ARC. But, if it's more appropriate to have a longer-term assumption, then maybe more should be going into the plan and not have, I don't think you're wildly off at 8%, but I don't see anybody above 8%. And I would say, and it's just a marker that our other county clients, all are at 7.5, and some are going down to 7. So I think you're definitely on the high side of what's out there now.
I'm just thinking what you're saying is true, but I mean, as Todd and members of the budget committee, when they take their budget to council for approval and they see this humongous, amount going in for pension contribution, then you have that restraint. But I mean, I know what you mean. You have to be realistic also about what your returns are.
Yeah. Well, what we're seeing some do is they say, well, maybe we slowly ease our way there, that maybe you go to 7.75. And sometimes it's easier to do it if you have a real good year. It's easier to at least start doing it at that point in time. That doesn't mean you can wait forever to do that, but sometimes the path, you might take just a little slower path, but I think eventually you probably do need to get there. Okay. You know, might make it a little bit more digestible.
Yes.
Yeah. I will also say that other things that we're seeing out there is a relook over at mortality assumptions. Okay, I don't know what mortality assumptions you have. I've looked at your actuarial report, I just don't recall. But if somebody has used the same mortality assumptions for the last 10 or 20 years, well, the reality is people are living longer. Interestingly enough, It's the men who are living longer than 20 years ago and not the women. But the women's mortality tables have not changed much. It's the men who are starting to live longer. And I'll be smart enough not to speculate why, but.
Seems to me they change that pretty frequently when they update it. On their list of things that they've changed assumptions for,
yeah,
that's one of the ones that they're always recalculating mortality.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing to do. I have some clients that they're using 1983 rates still, you know, but their quandary, actually, for ones who especially have, like, one of our clients, you know, firemen actually are living much longer because of new technology. So it used to be that the average fireman would live, they figured, about 10 years less than the average person. Well, now it's down to about 3. So that's great, except if people are living longer, you're paying out benefits longer. And so if you have a municipality that has, you know, a fair number of firemen, and it, you know, it's like, okay, yeah, we should adjust it, but wow, if it's tough enough to make the budget now, mm-hmm, you know, what do you do with that? So again, they're looking through those issues. But I think the point of all this is to say, it's one thing to look at assets. You need to look at your liabilities also, and both the size of them now and what's causing them to grow. And there are things that you can either, you know, do about slowing the rate of growth of those liabilities, but also making sure you most accurately project what those future benefits and future liabilities will be. It's just like running a business. You can, you know, it's not just the revenue, it's how much outflow there is. And when is that outflow? You know, David mentioned it. They have to sit on a little bit more cash now because their outflows are greater than inflows. And what you don't want to do is be in a situation that, oh, wow, we need money. Let's sell it out of, say, stocks right at the time the stocks have gone down. So you need to build some operating reserve to meet your cash flow needs. You know, yours is pretty equal right now. Your outflows and your inflows are pretty equal. But somewhere down the road, that's going to change. And so that's something that you need to continue to monitor. So at some point in time, you might need to have more of an operating account. You do have, basically what you're doing right now is you're setting aside about 1 year's worth of cash reserves to make benefit payments, and you're putting them in short-term securities. But that might, you know, over time, that component might need to change, or the amount that needs to be in short-term fixed income might need to change.
I'm wondering if, as Mr. Leahy suggested, we could ask our actuaries just to give us some idea of what some of those different, like,
returns.
7.75 or 7.5. And I would think that would be pretty easy for them just to plug into the program,
mm-hmm,
change it.
What if?
Great, and then give us an idea, like, based on last January's actuary,
yeah,
report.
Yeah, we can do that.
What the impact would be.
I really like to change actuaries. That's the first thing we need to do. Just not pleased with them. Haven't been pleased in 2 years. Remember, we weren't pleased, and then they assigned us to new people, and they seemed very responsive for a year or two, and now it's back to, so that's for another day. Yeah, I think you're right. I think they could probably plug those in
without
a lot of trouble.
Work or cost.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And what you'd want is long-term, not just sometimes actuaries will just give you 1 year. You want to see 20-year impacts on that. I can tell you, I've been to, and this is not to tout any actuaries over anybody else, so I'll leave names off of the discussion, but I've seen them come in, and they've actually put up a projector and said, okay, now, what do you want to test? Do you want to change that to 7.5%? This is what happens, okay? What if you get, if you project 7.5 or 7.75, but you actually get 6, what happens? What if you get 8.5, what happens? So you test not only the actuarial assumptions, but the return assumption, you know, what you actually get in the returns versus what you assumed. You can test the mortality assumptions. You say, well, if we change to this rate instead of this rate, you know. There's different ways of valuing your assets, okay, different methods of smoothing. Boom, they can click a button and do it live for you. And you can really, so, and then you can see the dynamics of all those together. And I think that's really, going back to your issue, is until you know the numbers, you really can't make decisions.
Are there regulatory or accounting policy-related issues that are going to be influencing our decisions in these areas? I mean, are there federal regulations that are going to be talking about rate of return assumptions and what they need to be and how they need to be calculated?
Potentially.
Other?
Yes, there are what they call GASB rules, but the dates of implementation are still, you know, fuzzy, and but they are requiring more disclosure and in a whole different way of looking at the liability part and the, then the actuary rate of return.
So if I may add to that, what's so you split apart. So there's one thing is, you know, corporations, you know, you have set rules as to what needs to be contributed, and the laws may change, but there's set rules that need to be contributed. Okay. There's a state's rights issues that goes around the issue as to whether they can, you know, they'll ever pass, and that's, that falls under ERISA. Okay, ERISA is a whole body of, you know, it was originally a law in 1974, but it's a whole body of law that's gone through over time. The federal government has stayed away from mandating those types of requirements because of the state's rights issues. Now, having said that, you have the GASB, which it's the accounting industry, which mandates how you need to report those on your financial statements. And if you split that apart from actual funding requirements, one is a cash requirement, you know, or that is calculated by the actuary, which is your ARC each year, the annual required contribution. GASB is saying, we're going to force you on your financials, not for your ARC, for your actuarial perspective, but for on your financials, to make a different calculation. The way you assumed your rate of returns are going to have to be different. The way you discount your rate returns are different. So I'd say directly, no, but indirectly, for some entities, if what it does is increase your liabilities on your financial statements, which will happen to anybody who is not fully funded, you know, then it will show a greater liability on your financial statements, not your ARC, but on your financial statements. And therefore, when you go out to borrow money, it may impact on your credit rating. Now, I'm going to take a leap and take this as a supposition, not as an actual observation, is that Sussex County is, you know, in the whole picture around the country, is your finances are very good. So I think it would have less, significantly less impact on you than, let's say, and so you know, I troop around Pennsylvania quite a bit, city of Pittsburgh, city of Harrisburg, whose funded levels are, and actually even a couple of dollars, funded levels are, you know, 50%. That's going to have a much greater impact on them because of the return assumptions they can use for calculating, discount for calculating the liability. So that's a long version of it, but these are some of the things that are coming up, but I think not that it doesn't impact you, but it's less of an impact than I think a lot of others. You know. Okay. So let's follow on. We'll go with the performance report. And I'll give you, as I mentioned last time, we've changed the format, and we've also, just to reconfirm that, we've changed the source of where we get our performance reports. We used to use the Wilshire Co-op. Now we use InvestorForce for our databases, okay, our universes, and some of our analytics. So that's why you see a different format, actually similar to the one you saw last quarter, but different from what you had seen in previous years. We also used that opportunity to make some other changes, and also add, we've hired another individual, actually on a consultative basis, but the chairman of the economics department at the University of Delaware, Jim Buckowitz, who, when I took my econ courses, I thought he was much older than me. Now I realize he's only 5 years older than me. But when I was in school, I thought he was much older than me. He writes our economic reports in these performance reports, and also monthly, we're now doing a newsletter, an education newsletter. So I think, I don't know if that's going out to all of you or if we're sending it to Susie and it gets disseminated. Do you know?
It comes to me.
Okay.
And then we send it out to all the
everybody
pension
else.
Committee members.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually, the most recent one we did, so our quarterly one is a 4-page one, and then our monthly ones are 2-pagers. The 4-page one deals with this benefit promise and all of these promises that have been made. Are they going to be fulfilled? You know, and, you know, in some municipalities, you know, I don't know how, quite frankly, I don't know how they ever do it. Like state of Illinois, I don't know how you ever fulfill that promise. You know, some of the cities that, you know, in in the Northeast, sort of the Rust Belt areas, how they ever fulfill those promises. It's going to be a huge liability out there that's, not well funded. Okay. Market environment. So give some context as to what's happened in the past quarter, and then we'll talk about performance first of the pension fund, then the OPEB, and then we were also asked to look at making some changes to the OPEB fund. And we'll talk about that and why. So under market environment, second quarter, the stock market was down, giving back some, but not all the gains of the first quarter. Refresh everybody's memory, the first quarter was very strong equity returns, better than double-digit returns, whether it was U.S., non-U.S., emerging markets. Lots was concerned about risk. What was going on in Europe? As David mentioned, there were some changes they've done to their portfolio because of the concerns out there. It's not that the U.S. looks great, but on a relative basis, it looks, looks more attractive than a lot of the other opportunities out there. So there's concerns out there. The potential euro breakup. Now, most people haven't really been talking about it. They've been talking about, what do they have to do? Well, there's a potential if it went all the way through that you could have a breakup of the euro. Whether that happened, I don't know. But anytime that's a perceived greater risk, what happens? There's a flight to quality. Assets move from the riskier investments, i.e. stocks, and some bonds. Keep in mind, bonds are not your father's bonds. They aren't just clip the coupon and send them in like they were 30 years ago. There's some bonds that are more aggressive, high yield bonds, which part of your portfolio is in, right? And treasuries be the other side of it. So treasuries, which most people would say probably are not a good long-term investment, the yields are so low, what's going to happen to them? But at least in the short term, it's been the flight to safety has been to the treasuries. So it's been driving down the interest rates on that because, although not as bad as it was in 2008 and early 2009, people are still wanting return of their money more so than return on their money. Okay. The Fed continues their operation twist. The short version of that is the intention is to keep long-term yields low. Okay. Banks are still primarily lending to their best risks out there. Energy prices fell due to economic weakness. Not that the economy was up, but not as strong as it had been for a while there. Concerns about, are we going to have a double dip recession? The consumer price index has gone down. Increases and CPI has remained actually fairly stable core inflation. And the unemployment rate has stayed fairly level for the last 3 months. And if you may recall, at our last meeting, we had observed that unemployment rate came down for several quarters, but there was a concern that that might level out. And I'll say at least for the last 3 months, we were correct in that it's pretty much leveled out. It's not that there aren't some increases in jobs overall, but it's not sufficient enough to lower the unemployment rate because you need to have, I forget the exact number, but you have to have an increase greater than 200,000 jobs, offhand. Something you have because of population growth. Okay. Now, looking ahead, so if you want to go into page two, go on to the right-hand side on the graph, you'll see this is known as the spread, and it's the difference in the interest rate between those different countries' 10-year treasuries and ours. So if you look at Greece, you see 24.2. In actuality, that means their interest rate is, and I'll round off, it's maybe 25.7. Ours is 1.5, theirs is 25.7. So the difference is the spread. Okay? That's how much more somebody needs to be enticed to buy Greek sovereign debt. Then Portugal, Spain, Italy, that's what all those are known as the pigs. Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. Those are the areas of concern. Some people look and say, well, Greece is such a small country. Who cares? I don't mean it in the wrong way, but how much impact can it have on the world economy? The concern is the contagion. What's next? Spain. Spain is having great difficulties. They had to come in and bail them out just several weeks ago. The concern then eventually was, does Germany say, you know, we're tired of this, we want to get out? But Germany actually gets some advantages of being in the euro. You know, we can go into that discussion if you like to. But all this has added more uncertainty into the market. As I mentioned earlier, when uncertainty occurs, then typically the stock market will go down because people will flee from the riskier investments and go into the more conservative ones. First quarter, it was the exact opposite. As for actual financial markets, if you go into page 3, bonds outperform stocks. Okay, you can see that the U.S. stocks, you know, U.S. fixed income was up 1.1, international was actually up 2.1, and emerging market bonds were up 2.5. Okay, you can see that on the left-hand side of that top graph. Stock markets, which are the three on the left, were all down. The U.S. equity is down 3.1. And just for clarification, that is the whole U.S. market, what we consider the whole U.S. market, the Russell 3000. So that would include large, medium, and small cap stocks. It's not the Dow Jones. It's not the S&P 500. It's really it's a broader market than that. Emerging markets were down 8.9, and international markets were down 7.1. That's a fairly common theme that you see, is that when the equity markets are down, the emerging markets, okay, are the ones that tend to be hit the hardest. However, over longer periods of time, it's expected that the emerging market equities should be one of the best, if not the best performer. Okay, that's where some of the better opportunities are. But their highs are higher and their lows are lower. So when it was the best performer first quarter, you didn't rush in and put all your money in there, fortunately. You don't want to follow what just happened, because typically the best performer one period becomes the worst performer the next. You look for the year to date, the U.S. has considerably outperformed the international and emerging markets. The U.S. market up 9.3. Typically, that's a total year return. Now, what's going to happen from July 1st to December 1st, whether that number will be higher or lower? If I knew, I'd be out in the Cayman Islands. But the U.S. market has considerably outperformed. But conversely, the emerging market bonds has been the best performer in the bond side. As for styles, so styles versus growth and value. Okay, so let's start with value stocks. Value stocks tend to be higher dividend paying than growth. They tend to be more in the energy, finance, and utility area. Growth stocks, you tend to see more of the technology, the healthcares, the ones that they're plowing the money back into the company instead of paying it out in dividends, with the expectations that they will have higher growth. And people pay a higher multiple of current earnings with the expectation, I stress the word expectation, that there should be greater earnings down the road. So they're willing to pay more for those. Sometimes that works out and sometimes that doesn't. This past quarter, the red, and all the ones that are in red, are the growth areas. So the dark red is large growth. So the medium, sort of almost a little bit pinkish, is mid-cap growth. And the light, the real pink, is small-cap growth. The blues are the value. And we purposely make it red and blue because the growth tends to be more volatile, you know, higher highs, lower lows. But you can see across the board, it's been the value stocks that did better than the growth stocks. For the year, the other way around, growth has done better than value. And again, that's usually the case. The higher highs tend to be with the growth, the lower lows tend to be with the growth. It's not always the case. Third quarter last year, when the market was down off quite strongly, value underperformed. So you can't take it to the bank that always occurs that way, but much more often it happens that way. Again, this is why your portfolio is structured to have both growth and value stocks, but because of conservative nature of Sussex County, you have a tilt toward value stocks. Tend to want to protect a little bit more in the down market, even if it gets up some in the up market. Okay? So your portfolio, the pension fund, when we get to, I think it's about maybe 55%, 55-45, and your OPEB fund is about 60-40 leaning toward value. Okay, and then last page on markets, and then we'll talk about your specific performance. Go on to page 4. You see the graph in the upper left-hand corner. You'll see the blue line is what the yields were on U.S. Treasuries at the end of March. And the gray or silver is at the end of June. And you can see that during the course of the quarter, interest rates came down on Treasuries. Again, driven by this move toward less risky investments, move away from riskier investments. And so, therefore, the longer the maturity of the bond, the better it did last quarter. That was also true third quarter of last year. But I caution you, when you look at that, on two things. Look at, say, the 10-year bonds. The yield was below 2%. Long-term yields on that are more like 5 and 5.25. So when we go back to the issue about what kind of long-term assumption you should have, well, if you have a 10-year bond, paying, say, 2%, and you hold it for 10 years, what are you going to get? 2% return. Okay. The actuary is assuming 5 to 5.25 to get this blend at 8. Those numbers don't work. Okay? They don't get you to that 8%. The other thing to remember is that goes up must come down. Well, that goes down must go up. So at some point in time, and I'll be wise enough not to speculate when, but I will speculate that at some point in time interest rates will go up. So although long bonds were the winner last quarter, somewhere the previous quarter they were the big losers. If interest rates go up at some point, they will be the big losers. And your portfolio has very little in long bonds. As overall balanced portfolio within the state pool, you have some in some long bonds. But the rest that's managed, the part that's managed by Wilmington Trust, is definitely on the intermediate to short end. Okay. You can see on the second graph, the returns actually on, you'll see the purple, it says 11.8. So for the quarter, holding long-term treasuries that were longer than 20-year maturity actually had a return of 11.8. Again, fabulous return. But I wouldn't tell you long-term treasuries is a good place to have the vast majority of your portfolio. There's different reasons why the state would do that as part of the pool versus what you would do in your overall mix. And then the big winner for the quarter, and this is the bottom graph, is the green. That's the TIPS, Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. Okay, they're there to really protect you in the event of you know, increases in inflation or expected increase in inflation. And a long-term winner for the year so far has been the high-yield bond areas. Just keep in mind, high-yield bonds are below investment-grade bonds. That's what high-yield bonds are. There's a reason why there's a higher yield. Okay. Go on to tab 2. And any questions about the markets before I go on to that? Okay. Observations. Your fund continues to do, I put the word well, it's actually very well. And especially in the down markets. Your fund ranked in the top 8% for this quarter. And strong performance by the state pool.
Yeah.
Okay. And you terminated Vanguard Global, which helped lower your overall allocation to the international stocks. If you recall, we observed that the state has a target of 20% in international equities. Okay. And the state you have about two-thirds of your money with the state. Two-thirds of 20 works out to be 13 1/3%. And your investment policy statement calls for, it's 12 or 14%. So with that in mind, then you really didn't need international with the piece that you have outside of the state. You were getting the international exposure that you wanted through that. And that's why you moved that money to rebalance your portfolio late last quarter, and got out of Vanguard and put into the other pieces. Okay. I will also observe that, the way the state manages the pool, their pool, is distinctly different than your investment policy statement. Okay, your investment policy statement is written more conservatively than the way they manage it. But you manage a $7 billion pool much differently than you would a $50 or $100 or $250 million pool. You know, if the state wasn't there available and what they could bring to the table and their pricing, power and their oversight and things like that, quite frankly, I'd sit here and say, No, I wouldn't want to see in hedge funds. No, I wouldn't want to see in private equity. No, I wouldn't want to see in high yield, or maybe not much. But you've got an interesting thing that very few others can, you know, outside of, you know, if you're in the state, you can, but outside the state, you can't do that. So it allows you to I'll say, invest like a bigger plan would, and at a reasonable cost level. But it's also, and we've talked about this before, it's also in totality more aggressive than what your overall desires that you've expressed in the past. And that's why you leave two-thirds with the state, and then you layer around that the other pieces. I think, if I may quote somebody, they said, the state's the wild child, and then you have the conservative child to blend it. And you've got a very nice combination that way. Okay, and maybe that's not fully fair to say the wild child, but it's, you know, it's just outside of what you would normally do. But I think it's a very good thing that you have money there. You know, and then what you've done is you have, you know, conservative equity managers and conservative fixed income, very conservative fixed income, to work around and build the whole portfolio. We see no need for changes, investment changes in this, and as you'll note, this is on page 8, my second bullet point is, need to consider reducing actuarial return assumptions, which we've already talked about today. Okay. If you look at page 9, two things I want to point out here, maybe three things. So year to date, the overall return for your total fund is 5.3%. If you go to the right-hand side, you'll see, would you like a copy of this one? Sure. We have extra one up there. The right hand side, you'll see what's called the upside downside capture ratio. And that just shows how your fund does in a quarter versus the policy index. Your policy index is, I think it's 48-12-40. Okay, 48% Russell 3000, 12% EFA, and 40% aggregate bonds. The way to read this is that since in your lower left hand corner, in the up markets, you tend to do about 85% of your policy index. So you don't do as well as your policy index in the up markets. But in the down markets, you've done about 70% of the down markets. Now that's good. You want to be to the left. So let me put some numbers to it. So in a down market, if it was down 10, on average, you've been down 7. In the up markets, if it's been up 10, you've been up about 8.5. So you've given up a little bit in the up markets, but you've protected yourself significantly in the down markets. And to me, that's a pretty good trade-off. You know? And I think it's consistent with Sussex County. You know?
Hey, Michael?
Sure.
I had a question, just a general question. I mean, we often hear about bonds being below investment grade, mm-hmm. that they're not eligible for pension, investment. But we can go ahead here and go with a high-yield bond, you know, so-called junk bond. I mean, I guess it's just not really it's not a regulation or anything. It's just a policy thing, decision. Is that how that works? Or?
Yeah, I'd say it's a board policy decision. There's no regulations against that. I'd say, you know, that in an overall portfolio, having some in high yield can give you some diversification. We look at high yield as actually sort of half equity, half fixed income. Sort of, you know, bonds and stocks, not always, but tend to move opposite each other, at least in the last 10, 15 years. High yield, like in the 2008, 2009, when equities were down, high yield was down also. So we look at it sort of like a half and half, you know. But all overall portfolio, if it's broadly enough diversified, having a piece in there can surely make some sense.
Sometimes you read maybe in the Wall Street Journal or somewhere, they'll say so-and-so company has been downgraded with, you know, triple B or whatever it is, and now they're no longer eligible for pension investment, something of that nature. I mean, you hear that.
Well, there will be some investment policy statements that will have prohibition for non-investment grade bonds.
Yeah.
So it's not a federal regulation. It's more of if somebody has an investment policy statement that prohibits the, you know, high yield bonds being in their portfolio. I think there has been some evolution in that thought process that people are starting to look at it a little bit more like we do, is saying that, you know, having a piece in your portfolio, or I actually like the way that state does it. Well, let me say what I don't like. My concern is if you just have an explicit allocation to high yield and say we're always going to have 5% in there or 10% in there, there's times when you really don't want to have high yield, okay? Where you get some tactical decision making like the state does, where you could say, well, we want to weight it less or weight it more now. you know, and hopefully they make the decision to, if there's time to get out. I like it more that way, where it's a, you know, there's some decision making as to whether to have more or less or none there. I will also mention that there has been so much money that has poured into high yield that we personally have some concerns about is there a bit of a speculative bubble in high yield right now because so much has poured into there. And you might say, well, why is so much poured in there? Because people have looked at it and said, wow, if we're only getting, you know, 0.5% or 1% at the CD, I can go to high yield and get 5% yield. Well, yes, but you've got more risk there. And if you have more and more money going in there, what happens to the prices of those bonds get priced up and maybe priced beyond where they should be. So we've got some a bit of skittishness about high yield right now because of that.
I'm glad we have it. I just kind of wondered, you know, you often see that, you know, and especially these days, you know, that whether they're no longer eligible or, you know, for pension plans or won't be considered for pension plan investments. So that's a negative form, obviously.
But yeah.
Just kind of curious.
Yeah, well, actually, I say, standalone without the state, I would probably say no. I would not, well, especially because I know even when we wrote a conservative investment policy statement, you guys wanted even more conservative than conservative. So, but having a piece the way you do, I think, is fine and appropriate.
Thank you.
Sure. Okay. The other thing to look at on this page is in the lower left-hand corner, and you'll see those rectangles. Some are in red and some are in black. Okay, the red ones are when the stock market has been down. Okay, and the black ones are when the stock market has been up. So over the last, since we've been doing the performance, so it started third quarter 2009, there's been three periods where your policy index, and I said stock market, but it's really your overall policy index, where your policy index has been negative. Okay, and in all three of those quarters, you've outperformed your policy index. You know, this past quarter by about 1%, third quarter last year by 2%, and second quarter 2010 by almost 1.75%. Okay. So again, when things are down, it's not that you haven't been down, but down less. Okay. The black ones are when the policy index has been a positive. And sometimes you're above and sometimes you're below. Okay. And this is, I think, a constant thing. You might, when things are positive, you go positive, just maybe not as fast as some of the others. But when they've been negative, you've been much more protective.
Can I ask a question on the numbers of the cash flows?
Yeah.
Our year to date is January. We're on a calendar year, correct?
Mm-hmm.
The withdrawals of $4 million. That seems high. They are to pay the pensioners. I'm thinking what I send you that you get that from.
I think we own, isn't it like $2 million a year, 2 point something a year for pensions?
Yeah, it's only $2 million a year. Now we'd close Vanguard. I don't know if you're considering that a withdrawal and then a contribution because it came out of the, didn't really come out of the fund. It just went to a different investment.
I suspect it is because you were the very first. The universe has just got run on Tuesday. So we were putting this report together yesterday. That piece I didn't get to proof. So I can find out for you.
Okay.
I just don't know.
Insurance contribution of $834,000.
Yeah, that could be, that's the plus.
That's probably the Vanguard piece.
If it's considered a contribution, there has to be a withdrawal because we would be off balance.
Yeah. So
that's probably more like $3 million. The net withdrawals is more like $3 million.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah, we'll check out those numbers.
Yeah. I'll call my office after here. While it's fresh on the mind.
Don't worry. Well,
be sure you include like what the county's holding in that account, right?
Your cash account. Yeah, I know. I know we send that, so I know they have that.
That's in there.
There's a couple. Okay. That's the. Yeah,
I'll find out. I just don't know off the top of my head.
Oh, that's fine.
Okay. So, as I mentioned, if you go into page 10, and this is against a public fund universe, you This past quarter, you ranked in top 8%. For the year-to-date, top 39%. The 1 year, the 24th percent. Keep in mind, the lower the number, the better here. Okay, so it's, and over the last 3 years, in the top 45%. So pretty, you know, consistently above average. Okay. It doesn't happen every quarter. As I say, in this particular quarter, both your defensive nature and the state had a very good quarter. The combination of the two is what ranked you so high. There are other periods of time that, like third quarter last year, you know, you had a defensive position. The state didn't have as good a quarter. So typically, not always, but typically, when the market's down, your conservative piece does better than the state piece does. And when the market is up, then the state piece does better than the rest of your pieces. And that's, I'll say, makes a good team.
What does that mean, Mike? Like, has, like, total fund composite, that's 8. So we were in the top 8%. But then that's Sussex correct. County Pension Policy Index, what is that?
Okay. So if you just indexed everything, okay, so if you just, instead of, so since your policy index is 48, 12, 40, if you indexed everything, and this is a point, and you rebalanced that every single month on the very last, after the market closed, that's what you would have gotten.
Okay.
The reality is, even if you index everything, you can't get quite that, because you don't, the last day of each month, say, oh, I'm going to sell $1,223,043 of this and move it over here. But if you did, and that just gives you some idea of saying, okay, did we outperform our policy index? Then you look at it and say, okay, so what caused outperformance or underperformance?
That disproves John Bogle, right, the founder of Vanguard, because he said you're basically almost as good going with an index fund as you are with a managed fund over time.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is not even close. I mean, so we're definitely doing much better with a managed.
Yes. And actually, what you have, our opinion is, I think, a combination of both. There's certain areas, like in large cap U.S. stocks, what's the probability that a manager is going to be able to outperform the index and you pay them fees? Because let's pick Apple or let's pick Microsoft. You know, it's not like somebody's going to find that as a diamond in the rough. Oh, now's a great time to buy Microsoft. Okay, but in the small cap stock area, in the international area, sometimes in some of the bond areas, that's where a good manager can add value. And so
we did pretty good.
Yeah.
This year.
Yeah.
Or this quarter.
Yeah.
Depending.
Well, and actually, long term. As I say, I think what you've designed and put in place has worked very, very well for you, and it's consistent. You know, I see some plans that they'll have one quarter where they do really well, but the next quarter they do really poorly. You know, yours has been pretty damn consistent above average each time, and if you're above average very consistently, longer term, you tend to percolate up near the top. Now, the one thing I'll say about that, though, is when the market goes very strongly, you're going to struggle to do as well as them, as the average plan. And what do I mean by that? You drive down the road at 60 miles an hour, and you've got your foot over the brake a little bit. I mean, that's just, okay. Well, if the sun is shining and everything, and everybody else is bombing down the road at 80 miles an hour, you know, they're going to get there faster than you. But when it gets cold and snowy and all that, I know you don't get as much snow as we do, but you do get some. Snow and cold, you know, and the weather's bad, you know, one that's bombing down the road 80 miles an hour, who's more likely to crash? They are. So keep in mind, universe, over this past time period, we're paid to be conservative, you look really good, okay? At some period of time, like the 1990s, you probably wouldn't have, if you're looking against peer groups, not as much because everybody else was, you know, they had to pedal to the metal, okay? So there's a lot of different pieces. You look at that, you look at how you do versus your policy index, you look at, you know, where your comfort levels are, okay? There's, I guess, just one or two other points, and then we'll move on to the OPEB because that's the thing that needs the most time. You go to page 16, you look at, this is DuPont Capital. If you may recall, the first quarter or two, they struggled a bit. They didn't do the policy index. But if you look at this page 16, their one-year return, they're in the top 10% at 6.3 versus 5.4. And over 2011, they're in the top 9%. Now, this goes back to what you were mentioning, though. That 5.4, although it's almost one percentage point worse, lower than what you guys did, that was still in the 14th percentile. So indexing was still way up to the top. Only 14% of the large cap core managers outperformed indexing. That's why I said that that's a space that's very tough for a manager to win. Okay, so it happens that DuPont did for you. Okay, but if consistently they don't, then indexing would be something we would look at here.
I see your point. A large cap stock is unlikely to have some business that's going to take off and show up in the stock price. I mean, this doesn't occur that often. And
right.
Might as well go index. And
Yeah. But for now, you've got a manager who's beaten that and not taking a lot of risk of doing that. So, you know, I'd say you'd sit with that. But if at some point in time they're not, that's probably what we would come back to you and say, let's not look for another active manager. Let's look at indexing in that space.
So we made a good investment. We went with DuPont so far.
Yeah. They're a very good firm. I'd like to see some more of my clients are starting to look at them and outside of the state. And they manage a $30 billion portfolio for the DuPont itself. So they've got some very sharp people managing it. Yeah. Okay. Fixed income is, you know, pretty much Wilmington Trust is doing what you asked them to do. Very steady Eddie. You know, no more than 25% in corporates, tight to the benchmarks. They're going to add a little bit each quarter, hopefully. You know, I've been satisfied with what they've done. Susie, mm-hmm. Feel the same way? Okay. So, okay. Any questions about the pension? So, summing up, it's worked well, and no needs to change. No. Now, I will tell you that we are the type of people. Sometimes I tell people, your plan did very well, but you do still need to make a change for such and such a reason, but not here. You know, we're very happy with the whole structure. OPEB, we talked about before, and that's why the main thing we want to cover today is that you took your initial, you know, move into that area. You went through the search. You had to pick among those that had responded. You've changed the law that allowed your consultant to bring names for consideration for you to look at, and that's what we're going to show you is three changes to look at, three names to look at for a change. I would like to clarify. I think, Dave, you had mentioned about the desire to move the OPEB money from the state to the outside. I think there was three reasons for that. And Claire, let me know if I'm correct. One was because it was all indexed, and you wanted to, you know, see what else.
We're charging us pretty healthy fees for index.
Okay. Right. Two, you had, I'll call it an administrative issue that they actually credited you about $1 million more than they should have, and then they had to come back and take it back. Okay. And three, I think it was also just the overall, if you look at the totality of all your assets, you want to make sure they were broadly diversified. So the state has, you know, 2/3 of the pension, but roughly about half of your total. Okay. And as good a job as the state does, you want to make sure that you have control and management over the totality of all that you have to fit more of what your needs and comforts are. Because they've got to design theirs and their asset allocations and their tolerance for risk based upon what the state's ability to take for risk. Municipalities and counties are different because if the state, if the pension fund doesn't do well for several years, they have more flexibility in their budget. You know, well, we'll raise taxes, we'll cut back on our spending, you know, we'll give less money to the municipalities and counties. Counties and the cities don't have that. You don't have the same level of flexibility, so you can't tolerate the same level of I'll call it uncertainty in returns.
I wonder how quick they're going to get into that back into the pool. You know, you never know.
Yeah. And at that point, you know, what I'd say what you'd want to do, I mean, I'll say almost two conflicting thoughts there. One is that you've decided you want to diversify all of your assets, so look at it as both pools of assets, okay? But potentially, so that would argue against not going back into theirs. The other side of it would be is, well, maybe part of it.
Yeah.
Maybe part of it. So, and I think at the time when they do make that available, then that's something that we talk about and say, let's talk about the pros and cons, and if you do a partial, how much how much a partial should be, and what does it do with the, you know, how do you want to build around it like you did on the pension side? S&P 500 was down 2.8% for the quarter. Your plan was down 2.5, so you weren't down as much as the S&P 500. But I'm not going to tell you it was a good quarter for this pool, but I'll show you why, and the changes that you want to do will address a fair amount of that. The plan year-to-date is up 3.8%. Your asset allocations are close to target, and the Allianz RCM disciplined equity was below their benchmark again, and so what you decided last quarter of saying you want to make a change there, the second report you'll see there talks about how we go about doing that. And Harding Loevner continues to do very well. Okay. Looking ahead, page 8, okay, fund changes. You know, this is what we would suggest: terminate Allianz RCM, terminate the Vanguard Value Index. Now, we're just going to recommend that you use a different Vanguard index. I'll get to that in a minute. Add the core index fund, that's Vanguard's core index fund, so it's really moving Vanguard from one spot to a different spot. Add an active core manager, and then reduce the allocation to Ridgeworth. What we want to do, when you put things together based upon the respondents a year ago, is you had sort of like the managers who managed the large stocks and the small stocks. What you were missing in the overall mix was some of the mid-sized companies. So part of what we want to do is to get some more exposure into the mid-size, what we call the Goldilocks. You can put that down if you want. Not too big, not too small. I can go through this, or we can jump to, okay, let's talk about changes.
Can I ask you one question?
Sure, go ahead.
On 25,
yep.
Where that chart on the top there, it says downside capture ratio. Does that mean that if the market's down, that we are
let me back up. Which page are you on?
25.
Okay. Wow. They've numbered mine differently than yours.
It's the
Is it the one that says upside capture rate? Is this page here?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's it.
Okay.
So on that top chart there,
yeah.
If the market's down, then with the OPEB, we typically are over 100%, 105% or whatever. If the market's down 100...
10, you're down 10.5.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And, okay, I see. Now, if it's up, we're only up 90% or 85% or whatever that is.
That is correct.
Okay.
Now that's...
This is sort of opposite of the pension fund.
It is.
That is correct, yeah. And that's why, well, first of all, two things to keep in mind. One is this is a shorter time period, so it's only a year and 4 months. But it's also why you need to make changes.
Right.
Okay. This is what we've discussed the last several quarters. The problem is you didn't have the mechanism last year to make those changes. You would have had to go through a whole new RFP process. Okay.
And we're
then
ready
be
now.
Subject to whoever happened to send in responses were the only ones that you could consider. Now you can, I think, with you know the steps that we're suggesting, that should move that over to the left-hand side. Yeah. In fact, with the mixes that we've done, it would have been over on the left-hand side.
What the chart right below that? What does that mean?
Okay, that is measuring, and actually, it'll be easier to explain it on page 9 of the pension because you'll see a line that's. If you go to page 9 of the pension report, does it have this? You have the same thing on the bottom right hand side. Okay, so in the pension, what that says is roughly 75% of the time, when the market's down, you've outperformed your policy index. Okay. It also says that when the market's been up, you've outperformed your index 30% of the time. So you might say, well, why do we give you both those? This bottom one shows you what percentage of times you outperform. The top one gives you the magnitude of that.
Okay.
And those observations, I'd say, would be consistent, again, of when the market's down, you do better, and when the market's up, you don't do it. You do fine. You do okay, but you're not beating the benchmark in the up one. But there's always a trade-off. Everybody would say, well, geez, when the market's up, I'd like to beat it. When the market's down, I'd like to beat it. Well, you have to pick which is more important to you. Yeah.
Just all based on historical performance, of course. So the betas of these various investments, is that?
Yeah, it's actually that it's actually based upon the historic performance of your actual portfolio. So we take every single quarter, okay, and so we look at it and say, okay, let's take all the up quarters, what your index did, and then what you really actually did, and then what that ratio is, and then look down quarters. So it's based upon your actual portfolio mix. Yeah. And that would point to a beta of less than one in your portfolio.
Mike, is there a general reason why the Alliance RCM Discipline Fund is not performing over a period of time? I mean, is there anything other than not picking the right stocks? I mean, is it just?
Well, they, it's not that every single time. First quarter, they actually won. They tend to be more aggressive. I mean, they tend to do better in the up markets and not as well in the down markets. So over the last roughly a year, we've had third quarter, the market was down strongly. Okay. Second quarter of this year was down a decent amount. We've had a lot of months with down quarters. They don't tend to protect as well in the down market.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so what we've brought you is three candidates who's really, I'll almost say specialty, is doing better in the down markets.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of wondered, you know, what happened.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, as I say, it was... picking or less of evils when you went through this before.
Yeah.
Okay.
Didn't have a great selection there.
Right.
Are these returns net or gross that we're looking at?
These are gross. Your net expense ratios, actually, you go to page 15. Well, yeah, mine says 15. I'm not sure. Under the OPEB. It actually gives a breakdown of each manager and then what's the overall expense ratio. Your overall expense ratio is 0.47. It's actually higher for the pension because the state's pool is 78 basis points. Okay.
Where is that?
It's on page 31.
31?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Now, you might wonder why mine has different numbers. When we first ran this yesterday morning, she ran it as two separate reports, bound mine, said, look, we already have yours. We won't run you another one. Then they ran yours and they put them all together. So you'll have to help me out with the numbers or page numbers.
Well, I guess Wilmington Trust fees are paid out of general fund, maybe. I don't know.
What are you talking about?
Well, we do have fees for Wilmington Trust.
Yes, you are correct. Yeah, it is now. Yeah, it's 20 basis points.
Okay.
Does that include buying and selling the bonds, or is that extra?
That would be, yeah, any commission charges when they buy or sell bonds would be separate. That would be their investment management fee. Actually, that's going to be another point. I'd say our average client has an expense ratio of about 40 basis points all in for a plan of size. That would typically be with indexed fixed income. So yours should be about 48. Although it says 47, you're correct. It's actually about 55 right now. But that's why part of what we're going to recommend is some of these changes that are going to lower some of your fees, both actually on your index fund and on your core equity.
We're not getting institutional rates either on some of these funds, I mean, are we? We're paying a retail rate?
No, you're paying institutional.
We are, okay.
Yeah, there's institutional loans.
Okay.
So... What are you recommending again?
Well, if you go to the next book.
Oh.
Okay. So we're recommending really three things. One is you move Vanguard from being a value index to their S&P 500. Okay.
to change from the value index to S&P 500?
Yes.
That's an index?
That's an index fund, and that's going to be even less expensive. That's going to be about 6 basis points.
Incredible what it is now.
Yeah. Pardon me?
That's incredible what they, how low they are now.
Yeah. Secondly, reduce the allocation to Ridgeworth. And thirdly is pick a new manager to replace RCM.
Now, if you go, go to the second page, if you would, of what I just handed out. Okay. So you'd have Vanguard Value Index, you would terminate them. You see the $2,020,000 taken away from them.
And that's because you think we have too much value now?
Well, that's part of it, but also, what if what you want to be is more defensive in nature, it's they're more better. How's that for English? There's more good choices in the large cap value area to find defensive managers, ones who protect better in the market, plus ones who tend to be more dividend oriented. So one of the concerns right now is that if the economy is not going to be real strong going forward, that the growth, the price appreciation may be less important and the dividend becomes more important. So have that, have those kinds of stocks that, that do that in your portfolio. So, so we're trying to accomplish really two things at the same time. So right now you have your active manager being your core manager and you're indexing on the value side. We want to flip-flop that. Have the core, the indexing in the core side and your active manager on the value side, okay?
So you're recommending basically we pull out of Vanguard Value. Where would that money go?
That would go, well, look at the sum of the three. So you'd pull out of that.
Mm-hmm.
You'd pull out of the Allianz.
Okay.
And you would lower the allocation to Ridgeworth Small Cap Value. You're over-allocated to small cap right now.
Okay. We're sort of rebalancing right now also.
Exactly.
Changing.
But just rebalancing within the domestic equities.
That's correct.
The value.
Okay.
Large then, cap, small cap, and equity.
And then we would add two funds. One would be the Vanguard. I use the term actually S&P 500. It'd actually be the Vanguard Russell 1000 index. And you might say, why that index and not the S&P 500? Because the Russell 1000 actually will give you more of the mid-sized companies, the mid-cap companies. So it helps fill that space where you sort of you're bit open in that space right now. And then pick a new large cap core manager and give them, you know, the mon- the numbers added up to you know just about $2 million.
Are the large cap core, BlackRock, ClearBridge?
Yes, among those three.
All right.
Well,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Well, if we go with the Russell 1000, $5 million, are we sort of overloading on mid cap or?
No, no. Actually, there's two reasons why we went to 5 million. We would have gone actually to about 4.5. So mid cap is still a small part of that overall versus the S&P 500. Okay, so although it stocks 501 to 1,000 because it's capitalization weighted, almost all of it's still in the large cap space. It's just going to get you some in the mid cap space. It definitely does not overload you in the mid cap. And also keep in mind we're taking money away from the small cap area, quite a bit of it, half of it. Okay.
The
other reason, and normally we would have said, actually, when we ran the numbers, it came out to be about $4.5 million. But at $5 million, you get a lower pricing. You get better. You get the institutional share class at $5 million. You don't at $4.5 million. So we thought, let's get the institutional pricing, and as this fund grows, we'll get you know. Then we'd add to the other pieces.
This will bring our cost. Our basis points down slightly too.
Actually, quite a bit because you're going to have more in indexing,
yeah.
And you're going to take money away from Allianz, which was at 69 basis points, I think, or 73, And all these other choices are considerably less expensive than that.
So a little money, hopefully, you know, makes performance sense. Is there too, hopefully.
Yeah, if I had to, and I will guess off the top of my head, but this probably save you about $25,000 a year some fees. Yeah, it's probably a pretty good estimate.
Yeah, great. Plus we got super
almost pays for the consultant just for that alone.
We got super diversification there too, so we're, it's a safe investments. I mean,
yeah.
Also, you know, 1,000 different companies there.
So that's what we recommend you do, but then you have to go through the list of three candidates, and we can go through that, and then you know maybe one of them percolates up that you say, oh, that's the right one. So hopefully maybe you had a little bit of opportunity to read through this, but I'll hit the quick highlights and then, so what do, you know, what do we want to do? So if you go to page one, this is the second bound report, okay? You want to we're looking to decrease the volatility in the overall portfolio. So this is not the report you just looked at, this is the one that says OPEB on the front of it. Okay, manager search. Reduce the volatility in the overall portfolio, reduce the overweight to value equities. So to your point, Dave, yes, we were trying to bring it down some. We still like the overweight to value, but we think it just had too much. Okay. Your current position is you have domestic large cap value, you have Vanguard value, large cap core, you have Allianz. We suggest replacing RCM with another large core manager and replace large value index with large core index. We believe the high quality equity strategy will offer better downside protection. Page two, what were we looking for in managers then? Better downside protection, lower volatility, lower portfolio beta, you know, increase the risk-adjusted returns, but also, very importantly, a manager that complemented the rest of the portfolio. You could look for all the other ones, but if it's not a good complement, then it's not, I like my sports analogies. If you've got a football line, if you need a tackle, you go find a tackle. You don't find a wide end. You know, and that's what you're looking for. I'm a soccer guy, so maybe I have my words right. But and the three choices we came from that were BlackRock equity dividend, Legg Mason, Clearbridge is the manager, and then Vanguard. But do note that Vanguard, and even though Vanguard and Bogle was founded on indexing, about half of their funds now are active managers also. But they don't actually manage. Vanguard owns the fund. It's a firm called Wellington, who's the actual portfolio manager of the mutual fund. Okay, and that's a dividend growth fund. Okay, and part of what we were looking for were ones that had, you know, earlier was this dividend component to it. You know, page three just shows, because I've got an analyst that wants to show us everything. The start. We're looking for somebody that's sort of in the middle there. Don't have to be exactly in the middle, but in the middle or slightly to the left. And all three of them fit that. Okay. So now go on to tab two.
These are all no load funds.
These are all no load, no 12B1, institutional share class funds. Yeah.
I'm just wondering, is there anything to be taken from these scatter diagrams when you see BlackRock and Legg Mason with dots all over the board,
mm-hmm.
and Vanguard with dots more correlated to the middle. Is there anything to be, do you read anything into that that's significant?
Yeah, my psychiatrist showed me these things, and I said it was, actually, two things I would take from that. One is you see less dots in the Vanguard one, and that's because they have a smaller number of holdings, okay? The second is that Vanguard, it tells me Vanguard, even though all of them are core, you know, Vanguard's picking everything sort of right in this cluster here. And the others might have some here, here, and here, and then blended together gets to there. Okay. I don't think I draw from there, like, therefore I like this one better than that. It's just another piece of data and looking at and understanding that, you know. Okay, so page five, under the second tab, this is just the index fund that we're suggesting you use. If you go down, you'll see expense ratio of 0.8%. I said 0.6 on the S&P, but this one's 0.8. What you're paying for indexing now is 0.12, so that's a one-third savings on that. Okay. On page 6, some information on each of the funds. BlackRock, huge, it's the biggest money manager, surely in the U.S., and I think in the world. They manage almost $4 trillion of assets. In this particular investment strategy, you see 30, that's $30 billion in this strategy. Billions, trillions, you know. But they started this strategy in 1987, so it's been around for quite a while. Three portfolio managers, expense ratio of 0.76, number of holdings 112. ClearBridge, okay, firm assets, $57 billion. This particular strategy, $7 billion. The strategy has been around for a long, long time. Expense ratio, 0.61, 102 holdings. And Vanguard, but managed by Wellington, Vanguard themselves manages, it says 1.9, so almost $2 trillion of assets with them. But Wellington, because they're the sub-advisor, manages about $719 billion. In this particular strategy, figure about $10 billion. Three portfolio managers, but definitely the lowest expense ratio. Vanguard's known for that. They drive them to 0.31%. Okay?
I like their turnover ratio. They're low. You know, right. Like some of the ones you'll get now, they're way up there. You kind of wonder what they're doing. I mean, if they're not, you think they have a policy and stick with it rather than churn it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you do want some level of turnover because you want them managing the money and changing, you know, selling stocks and buying stocks when they don't like it. But these ones, you know, you go back to the, you know, go back to the 90s, well, you'd see these managers, they'd have 75, 100, 150% turnover. It's because they were chasing the hot thing, you know, and they were, oh, now we got to dump this and buy this. They weren't really long-term investors.
Yeah.
You can see by these percentages, these are long-term investors. In a moment, you'll see what types of stocks they buy, and you'll see that's pretty consistent with that.
I always try to think of what would Warren Buffett do. And I know from reading books about him, he hangs on to his, he gets rid of them as needed, but he's my
what would he
hero.
Do, Jeff?
He's my hero. No, he hangs on. He doesn't trade a whole lot.
Maybe we could send him an email and come back and yeah.
So he's doing better than I am, though.
Yeah. Thank
you. Amazing.
You see information on what they're looking at. In all three of these, you're going to see about the same theme. You're not going to see wide differentiation in what they try to do because we were looking for a particular type of manager. You know, value, low volatility, protecting the down market, higher dividend. So it's not, the themes you're going to see aren't wildly different. Ability to pay dividends, market, you know. So, Legg Mason, same thing, high quality, superior balance sheets. Vanguard, looking for dividends, you know, low debt to capital ratio, so low leverage. Strong operations, effective management. One of the things that we need to be cautious of, and is that when you look for stocks with high dividends, okay, you have to make sure it's not high dividends because A, the stock price has gone down. So if the company could be doing worse, and if they keep their dividends up there for a while, their dividend yield's going to look great, but the company itself is not going forward. B, you want to make sure that they're plowing at least some money back into the company, you know. So it's not just higher dividends. You want good companies. So if you look at page 10, it shows you the type of holdings they have. Okay, so BlackRock, okay. ProShares isn't, you know, say a widely known name, but J.P. Morgan, Chevron, Wells Fargo, Exxon. So a lot of energy, a lot of finance. You know, ClearBridge, and going back to your question about looking at that, you know, two of them, their stars were right in the middle, and then in BlackRock, the star was a little bit more to the left. That meant their holdings were a little bit more value-oriented, and that shows up in their holdings because they tend to have a little bit more in energy, a little bit more in finance in their top holdings, as you see there.
And Walmart.
you know, ClearBridge, Apple, Exxon, Microsoft, et cetera, and Vanguard, you know, I'll say some of the real traditional names, Johnson & Johnson, Pepsi, Target, Microsoft, you know, Exxon. Page 11, you see the breakdown in, you know, in their allocations. I think the one couple that I would highlight, if you go to the third one over, it says Infotech, so informational technology. The benchmark itself, and that's the gold, 20% of that is in information technology. You see very distinct differences here, though. ClearBridge actually is a little heavy on that, and BlackRock is very light on that. I don't know what conclusion I draw out of that, because one of them is right and one of them is wrong, but only time will tell you which one. One that I would pay attention to also is the one that says CONS staples. That's consumer staples. Think of those as the things that people have to buy no matter what the economy is like. So Campbell's soup, is, you know, detergents, things that you're going to buy no matter what the economy is like. And those are the ones that tend to be the most stable of them all. Now, in this case, Vanguard has the highest allocation to that area, but the other two aren't light on those. So.
But you like either three of them. Or are you making a recommendation on one?
Well, our relationship is not right to make a specific recommendation, but sometimes, most of the times we go through the search and there's, I'd say I would be neutral on any three.
Okay.
These are the three best we came up with, but there is one that I'd say internally we all thought was the best choice.
We have to guess.
Well, I'm not going here.
To rate.
Well, what I would say, if all of them look fairly consistent, and I would not go to price solely, but if all of them look fairly consistent, fairly, you know, then price might become a strong consideration.
Okay. Hear that, Jeff?
What's it start with, the first letter?
Can you read that?
That's all. Just the first letter starts with.
No, we got it.
If
pricing is, if it's all consistent, you go to price rather than return?
Well, that would not be. So go to page 17 for a moment, if you would. Yeah, no, return would be very important, style,
if
philosophy.
They're all equal.
But if you go through all that and you say, wow, I can't make. And if one is half the price of the other.
Right. Where's the price at?
Okay.
What page is
that?
But
go to 17. So that, remember the up-down markets we talked about before?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you see the green, which was Vanguard, is the one that has done the best in the down market. All of them have done very well in the down markets, and that's what we were looking for.
Right.
But the one that did the best in the down markets was Vanguard. The one that did in the up markets was BlackRock. So, you know, if you're looking for better downside protection, you would lead toward Vanguard, at least historically.
And their cumulative returns have been the highest.
Well, that's another good point for them.
For Vanguard, right.
How about if we go with two of the three?
Well, yeah, what if we busted up and did all three of them?
Still have $1 million.
Was that not a big enough? If we went with two, it'd be $1 million each, but if we went with three, you're taking it down, you know.
You could surely go with two. I would not go with three.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wouldn't go with three. Because if you're going to do some other diversification of the portfolio, there's other areas I'd like, you know, we're going to come back next quarter and say, okay, so this was the big major thing you need to do, but there's other little things we'd like to tweak. So, and we might want to, you know, leave some space for some other tweaking some other places. So I definitely wouldn't go with three.
So what's Warren Buffett say for two, Jeff?
Yeah. But we're definitely going with you recommend the Russell 1000 Index Fund. I mean, that's the, you know.
Yes, that's what I would, we would specifically recommend that as the index fund.
And maybe split the other two between the 2 million, possibly, if we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're saying, or what do you think?
The other 2 million between
two
of the three, BlackRock, ClearBridge, or Vanguard.
Yeah. So,
you have to make a motion, see if we got a vote.
Dave?
You think that would help Jeff to diversify a little further?
Yeah. I mean, $1 million, I mean, that's a significant amount of money to put into one, and just we kind of check them out next quarter, but that's not very much time, but, you know, in a while to see which one does
better. Yeah, you give them time. Well, and actually, as you add assets to the portfolio, I wouldn't add more, then I would add to those two. I wouldn't add to the index, because the index is actually a little bit more than we would have normally put in there, but we wanted to get that price break.
So who do you like second, Jeff?
That is a good question.
So did you decide on the first one yet?
Wow.
The Vanguard.
Not that I
do better.
Not that I was leading you in any direction. But
I mean, their cumulative returns are higher.
Yeah.
On page 16, 1, 3, 5, and 7 years. And then... In a down market, they.
Two.
Can you explain this chart?
Sure, sure. So you're on page 17, are you?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's take BlackRock as an example.
BlackRock.
Nice. In the up markets, they did about 95% of their index. So if it was up 10, they were up 9.5. In the down market, they only were down 80% of it. So if the market was down 10, they were only down 8.
Yeah, like BlackRock, you're going with a winner, I think, for a long period of time, and they're huge in their industry. A little more on the expense, but if they're returning the...
Susie, so looking for me or not?
I mean, I don't think, you know, we could lose, really, in the long run.
Well, it does give you a little bit, I'll say a little bit of juice in the portfolio, that Vanguard's going to be a little bit more protected than downward. So splitting it, I would have, you know, personally, I'd be very comfortable with that also.
And their cumulative returns, most of those look like they're second for the most part. Well, not 1 year, 3 years, 7 years. And they were ahead of ClearBridge 10 and 15 years.
I read Bogle's book. I'm influenced by that greatly, and I just wonder, with such similar styles, how likely is it over any period of time that, say, BlackRock would outperform, say, Vanguard by 30 basis points, because that's the difference in the fee level. And they're so similar, well, maybe they're not all that similar, but they're in the same space. So they have to do that much better just to stay even.
With the fee.
And so if, you know, I'm thinking if there was just one, I'd be leaning toward Vanguard. But Vanguard looks so much like our other holdings in terms of conservatism and downside protection that we might want to have, you know, have some of that BlackRock in there.
Mm-hmm.
To help give us a little bit more on the upside.
Yeah.
One's better in up market, one's better in a down market.
Yeah.
You kind of split the difference.
Yeah. If I were to go with one, I'd be thinking about Vanguard, but I certainly wouldn't be opposed to the idea of half Vanguard and half BlackRock. That's just where I sort of sit.
I like the idea of splitting between the two also. Well, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, Vanguard's got an excellent, as far as expense ratio, and they're, you know, they're performing very well. I mean, so you're getting good value there for your money.
Yeah, I agree.
If you want, Jeff, you can make a motion, and we would have to make it to where we are closing out Vanguard Value and Allianz, and you have to read it from this sheet because there's other transactions, and opening Vanguard Russell Index, and then the BlackRock and Vanguard, what's the other Vanguard name? Wellington.
Yeah, the, and Ridgeworth is, we're just decreasing
roughly, roughly for $1 million each, because you don't know what the value is going to be when I close these out.
Yeah, just say.
Just say to split the difference.
Yeah, the balance of what's left
the
over.
The balance would be shared equally between BlackRock and
Ridgeworth. We're just lowering our position.
Yeah.
We're not getting out of it.
You could say rebalancing per schedule provided, because it's got the details, and then the balance, the the new large core manager to be shared among BlackRock and
Vanguard. Sure.
Something along those lines.
See,
for Nancy.
It's my first motion I've ever made in my life, but I'll go ahead and start. Yes, I'd like to make the motion that at this time we close out our position that we currently have in the Vanguard Value Index Fund of a little over $2 million. Also to close out our current position in Alliance RCM Discipline Fund of over $3.4 million, closing out the balance of both, and also lessening our current position in Ridgeworth Small Value, Small Cap Value Fund, lessen that by $1.6 million, and then to reallocate those funds into three new funds, of which we would be investing $5 million into the Vanguard Russell 1000 Index Fund, and also to split the investment of over a little over $2 million currently into two new funds, the BlackRock Equity Dividend Fund and also the Vanguard Dividend Growth Fund. And I believe that would, as far as rebalancing our portfolio and reallocating our assets for the OPEB fund.
Okay. I have a motion, as Jeff described, per the spreadsheet provided by Pierce Park Group to reallocate our assets. Is there a second?
I'll second.
I have a motion and a second to reallocate our assets per spreadsheet, including three new investment managers, Vanguard Russell 1000 Index, Vanguard Dividend, and BlackRock, and I'll take a vote. Mr. Leahy?
Aye.
Todd?
Aye.
Dave?
Aye.
Jeff?
Aye.
And I say aye. Motion passed. So I will work that up for County Council at a future date soon. Try to get it in before a 2-week break. We can get them. It takes a while to move that assets around like that. A lot of letters and stuff like that. One bit of additional business and then we're done.
If I were just. And actually, what's my, with, since you have the custodian bank,
push it right there.
It puts
tell
it right
them
there,
do, yeah.
And the custodian bank.
That's nice.
Does, yeah, you don't have to go to each of the managers
yeah.
and tell them.
Because we do that, yeah, they're already there at Wilmington Trust. I just the funds are right there. Just tell them to switch it up.
And she will buy. They will buy and yep. sell the same day, so you're not sitting out of the market. That's always a concern.
Good
if
point.
You sell, you have to wait till money comes in. You could be sitting out. We'll buy and sell
right.
simultaneously.
I mean, we've never really used the custodian other than to be the custodian. We haven't had any changes in our assets until now, so this will really be advantageous. One additional point, additional business, changing in the way we approve the minutes. When Nancy sends the minutes out as draft, if you would like to make comment, that's fine, but we will not be approving them through email. We'll approve them formally at the next meeting. So you can read them, make comment. She can make changes and then recirculate drafts, but we'll just treat it like we do at County Council, bring them in the next meeting to be approved. That's all I have, unless anybody has something else.
We'll even draft up the letters for you for the custodian.
So. Oh, okay. And I think I do have a draft that I received from Pierce Park Group of the investment policy statement review that I'll circulate for discussion in the next meeting to see if it's time to take a look, see if we want to change anything up. It's been 5 years, I guess.
Just on the pension, not
just
the
OPEB.
It's been 5 years, so you know we've
been
on
that
a both a marked up version
it.
And a clean version of some changes we think should be there.
Thank you. Meeting dismissed at 11:55.
Thank you.